short timers today.
The House Committee on Revenue for Thursday, June 1st, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we have 52 minutes, so I'd like to see if we can move along with our work. First, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2270. Colleagues, House Bill 2270 is the prohibitive taxes on merchantable forest products harvest that currently contains blanks, goes to the Ways and Means Committee. My hope is that we can send it without recommendation. Representative Benz?
Sure. I move House Bill 2270 to the floor without recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Yeah, by prior reference.
By prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2270 without recommendation to the floor and with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion?
Looks like Paul's coming.
It doesn't. Okay. So we have to add the prior reference. Now, that's interesting. This is not what they normally do, is it?
Normally, it does have a problem.
Do you mind modifying your motion?
Happy to.
Happy to. How? Thank you.
What's the...
It just does not have a prior reference, but it needs one because there are blanks that have to be filled in.
Do you want the motion with the words prior reference or not?
Please. Without prior reference.
Without prior reference. Okay. Mr. Chair, to restate the motion, I move House Bill 2270 to the floor without recommendation.
And with a subsequent referral
with
the Committee on
Ways and Means without prior reference.
All right, thank you. Representative Benz moves. We'll restate the motion. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2270 to the floor without recommendation and with the added reference to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2270. And we'll open the public hearing on House on Senate Bill 162.
Well done, Christine.
Chris?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 162 makes a series of technical clarifications and a couple policy changes and policy clarifications. Mm-hmm. A lot of this may look familiar to the committee. You heard the concept in House Bill 2054 earlier this session, but what the bill does is it removes rulemaking authority for DOR to determine if C corporation tax credits may be claimed by S corporations. It also then adds to statute the tax credits for which DOR has already made that extension. They're added to statute, so there is no change in which tax credits can be claimed by which taxpayers. There's just a list of tax credits in the bill or in statute. So it makes that policy change, just removing the rulemaking authority for the Department of Revenue and then modifying it so there's a no change in with respect to who can claim the tax credits. Then it makes a number of technical fixes and policy clarifications for the Working Family Dependent Care Tax Credit, which was a tax credit created by the 2015 legislature. And basically what it does, and I've tried to do this in order through the bill, it extends the tax credit to non-married taxpayers seeking work or going to school. It limits the qualifying expenses to the amount of income earned in Oregon. It disallows the credit for amounts of dependent care paid with pre-tax dollars and aligns with federal law the timing of the date for determining the age of the qualifying dependents. That's on top of the table there, just moving from December 31st to January 1st. It also requires taxpayers to have earned income to claim the tax credit, and it also finally prohibits interest from being paid on the refundable portion of the tax credit. I have been in contact with the Department of Revenue this morning just recently, and there may be a technical issue that we may need to work through on some of these definitions. And then the last thing it does is it clarifies that assessing a penalty does not need to be done specifically by the director of the Department of Revenue. It just removes the reference to the director so that somebody in the Department of Revenue can do that through their normal course of activities. And all of these changes apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2018. You do have the fiscal and the revenue statements, and it's a no fiscal impact and a no revenue impact.
Wonderful, thank you. Do we have any witnesses?
Nobody had signed up.
Nobody signed up, but the department has concerns. Please, yes. Sorry, I should have recognized you.
That's okay, for the record, my name is Lois Williams with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And as Chris indicated, we talked just briefly about whether or not I needed to sign up, so I'm happy to provide just a brief overview of what the small technical issue is. One of the amendments that was made as this bill was coming through the Senate was to clarify that you needed to have Oregon earned income. And so the phrase that was put into the bill was income earned in Oregon. But what that leaves us with is taxpayers who, for example, live in Portland but maybe cross over to Vancouver to work, that's outside of Oregon. So we have contacted Chris to just ask for a little bit more time to study that with him to find out if that one phrase needs to be changed in the bill.
And could I say, since you're going to take time anyway, if it's at all of a concern, we should amend it. I understand the point you're making. I'm sure there are people who drive the Columbia River Bridge the wrong way every day to work in Washington, but they owe Oregon income taxes because they live here.
That's correct, Chair Barnhart. And, of course, it would happen even just with people who frequently travel for their work. They work part of the time in the state of Oregon and part of the time out of the state.
Elsewhere. All right. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nobody wants to be heard on otherwise on Senate Bill 162. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 162 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 701. This is Connect. Reconnect.
Excuse me.
Bless.
Salute.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 701 is the annual Reconnect bill, in which certain administrative statutes are connected to the Internal Revenue Code. And the measure updates the provisions from a connection from December 31st, 2015 to December 31st, 2016. And it updates references in various governing statutes, and that includes the PERS system, annual benefits payable to members, and specifies rules about minimum distribution requirements under certain circumstances, and relates to benefits and service credit for a period in the uniformed services. The measure updates the connection to the federal code that defines shareholders and S corporations that may represent their companies in the proceedings before the tax court magistrate or the Department of Revenue. It updates the connection to the Internal Revenue Code to define which organizations may qualify for consideration for a charitable tax checkoff, and it updates statutes governing the Oregon College Savings Plan, individual development accounts, and unemployment insurance to connect to the latest version of the Internal Revenue Code, and that is as of December 31st, 2016. It updates any references to the terms from the Internal Revenue Code for Chapters 315, 316, and 317, and it specifies that if a refund is due to a taxpayer for a tax year beginning before January 1st, 2017, due to any retroactive treatment from these federal tax connection changes, then the refund would be paid without interest, and it also cancels any interest or penalties from any deficiencies caused by the reconnect. So the majority of our impact from the connection to the Federal Internal Revenue Code is from the rolling reconnect, which is an ongoing connection that we have to federal tax code. And so some of those provisions can affect the amount of revenue that comes into Oregon. But it is not actually part of this measure. This measure is more for definitional reasons in some administrative statutes. Notably, a result of the rolling reconnect, and the connection that's ongoing, is that there's been a number of extenders that were actually allowed to expire for 2017. Primarily in the Protecting Americans from Tax Act of 2015, and that is the exclusion of home mortgage forgiveness from debt discharge income, and it was extended through 2016 but not extended to 2017, and that can affect Oregon's revenue. Approximately $7 million a year in revenue is gained from that provision. There were some a lot of other things that weren't connected or weren't extended to 2017. And another noteworthy provision that wasn't extended is the qualified tuition deduction. And that is no longer available for tax year 2017. Mm-hmm. And so the impact to Oregon is a positive $3 million per year and $6 million per biennium approximately from that that provision. But that's all a result of that rolling reconnect that's in statute, and this measure doesn't actually impact that. The measure has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact this time. Sometimes when their earned income tax credit provisions are changed, the measure can have a revenue impact. But this time around, I did not see anything that indicated that there was a revenue impact.
Okay. And the rolling reconnect affects the definition of income that we're tied to automatically.
Yes.
Right. All right. Do we have any witnesses? No witnesses. All right. Well, colleagues, we've held our hearing. I commend the. It looks like a very straightforward bill to me, including the parts about interest. But I don't want to work it today. It's 27 pages long. I want to give everyone a chance to read it. It's a fairly fast read because most of the changes are some other date to 2016, mm-hmm. Except for the last two pages. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill. Is that 701?
701.
And open a public hearing on a Senate Bill 936. Ah, we do have some people.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 936, the be-engrossed version. It's a bill that's making changes to a permissive property tax exemption program, if you will, the Strategic Investment Program, or the SIP. And just as a real quick brief background on the SIP program, then I'll go into the two changes that are being made in the bill. But the Strategic Investment Program, it's a property tax. Again, it's a permissive property tax exemption program, so it is available to the local governments. But there is a rural and an urban component, and the changes, there are two sets of changes within 936. The first is relating to rural SIP programs, and so as a reminder, the Strategic Investment Program, it offers a 15-year property tax exemption, and it's for large capital investments by businesses and traded sector industries. And the way that the exemption works is there's a minimum investment that has to be made by the business to qualify, and then it's the amount, or you can think of it, the value of the property above that minimum amount, that's the value of the exemption. So there's a minimum threshold you have to meet, and then the amount above that is the actual exempt value of the property, with the amount below the minimum, which the minimum thresholds are, in the rural areas are, that's the cap, excuse me. 25 million under existing law, and that's going to be the change in the 936. But so under the urban area, it's 100 million, it's 25 million in rural areas. So if you had a project that was worth $100 million, the taxable portion would be 25 million, with the exempt being that $75 million difference. And of course, there are community service fees as well, and that's part of the changes in the bill. So the first change in 936 is adjusting that minimum threshold amount that would be taxable in the rural areas based upon the total cost of the project. And you can see that up in the SMS. So the total cost, if it's less than $500 million, would stay at the $25 million taxable threshold. As the value of the total cost of the investment project goes up, so when you're $500 million to $1 billion, the minimum or the taxable amount becomes $50 million, with the amount above that becoming the exemption amount, and it goes up to $100 million there for total cost of projects above $1 billion. So that's the first change. And again, this is for the rural area project. The urban areas are left unchanged. The second change in the bill is increasing the cap on the community service fees. So right now, the community service fees are $2 million in urban areas, the cap, or $500,000 in rural areas. It would increase that to $2.5 million regardless of the area. So both the rural and the urban areas would have the cap increased to $2.5 million for the community service fees. So those are the two changes in the bill.
Thank you. Let's hear from Doris Penwell and Tony Hyde. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doris Penwell from Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm joined by two gentlemen associated with AOC. First of all, I want to say that Tony Hyde is a former Columbia County Commissioner and has used this program for a huge investment. He inspired AOC in working with other county commissioners to bring this forth to you. So Senator Johnson sponsored the bill at the request of AOC. The other gentleman here is Mike MacArthur from AOC. He's our executive director, and he's also from a county that has used this particular program to get some very large investments in the county that he came from. So very quickly, you heard a good introduction by staff on what the bill is. There are just two really different changes: increasing the thresholds of taxes that can be captured by the county after they've negotiated the deal and gotten it approved by Business Oregon. These are big investments. We have six Oregon counties to date that have used these investments. And in spite of what we expected when this bill went into the rural portion of this program went into effect in 2005, the investments are way over what anyone ever anticipated. And with our experience that we've had within these counties, we have really realized we needed to make some changes to capture more of the taxes that should be due on these large investments. And that's why this is before you.
But we lowballed it.
Pardon?
We lowballed it.
But, you know, we do this a lot. So here we are. The other important change is the increase of the community service fee for both urban and rural projects. This program went into effect 20 years ago, but in 2005, the rural thing went into effect. So now we are at a point where we think that we need to up that payment as well per year. And that escalates 3% every year. So that's in, as described, up to $2.5 million for any project. We are in the middle of negotiating some projects in several counties, and we wanted to be sure that this doesn't go into effect just before something is done with the negotiations. So we have asked that all of the changes in this program be made 91 days after signee die, as we might. And we've talked to a number of companies about this change. We've talked to the counties, and they all seem to be in agreement that that's what we should ask for. So why don't I turn it over to Tony Hyde, unless you have any questions.
Well, let's hear from everybody, and then we'll ask questions if there are any. Mr. Hyde.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, for the record, and my name is Tony Hyde. I was a Columbia County Commissioner for 20 years and 7 years before that at City Council Mayor. So I've been involved in these type of negotiations for a long time. And I was, in fact, sitting on the Economic and Community Development Commission of the state when this came through. And we were trying to get some parity for rural communities. So we came up with the rural SIP. And at that time, even myself, we thought of small communities, small projects, and that's simply not the case. You go to Sherman County or Prineville, and you can see that just because it's a rural county does not mean the investments are going to be small. So as you said, Chair Bernhardt, we lowballed it. We made the assumption that $100 million was going to be a giant project in a rural community, and we set that threshold at $25 million. We're just simply leaving too much money on the table. And so this is a fix for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties, also Sherman County. Throughout Representative Smith's district, we have seen the development of large wind farms, which are about $1 million a megawatt, $1.5 million a megawatt. There's 1,000 megawatts in Sherman County alone, and Gillam and Morrow County more. So we never anticipated this would be the application of the SIP for these large expensive investments, but the value of Sherman County, in my experience, went from $200 million to $2 billion. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of scale we're talking about, and so this is much more appropriate for that type of investment.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here. I just want some clarity on this because we hear and talk about lots of different property tax exemptions and programs, and I know we talked a lot about the SIP in 2015, but have not as much this session. So is there anything that requires the counties to do the SIP? Do you have to relieve? Do you have to offer them that property tax exemption? Are you required to?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Vice Chair Smith Warner, there is nothing required. This is a purely permissive piece of legislation and program that may be used in order to capture the investment into your county as opposed to another county or another right across the border. There are other incentives that might be used, and Representative Smith could speak to those. Some counties have found that works for them. Others have found that the SIP, which gets an investment every year in taxes to all of the taxing districts, this seems to work pretty well for them. So they are more willing to look at this program as opposed to another program. Just about any company that is investing these large amounts of money are going to look for some kind of incentive if they're going to make the deal in your location. So for the cities, for the counties, for the companies that have made these decisions, these have worked for them. Others haven't, and there have been times when they thought about it, but then they went to some other program or didn't invest in Oregon.
May I follow?
Please, son.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Two other brief things. Number one, is there a timeline? Like when you enter into a SIP with a developer of a project, is there a timeline? Like your taxes will be waived above that amount for X number of years? Is that established in statute, or is that negotiated in each project?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, it is in statute. It is a 15-year tax exemption. And it's quite well spelled out in the statute what the provisions are that must be met. There are other provisions that may also be negotiated in these arrangements that have been very helpful also. And it really depends on the type of company it is, the kind of county it is, the kind of services that are required for the business that is located. So it's fairly open-ended, but there are a lot of provisions that are in statute, and Business Oregon does keep very close track of how the negotiations are going, and they approve everything that happens.
And one more quick one.
Please,
Thank you. And because the rural SIP started in 2005, we do not yet have a county that has discovered what happens after the 15 years. Does the business close up and go away when they have to start paying property taxes? Kind of what are the plans for that? Because 17 now, I mean, I would assume since the rural SIP just started in 2005, there might be a project that was set for 15 years, and now those businesses are going to have to start paying property taxes at the end of that 15 years?
Let Tony answer that if you want.
Chair Bernhardt, Representative Smith, or Warner, excuse me. I would say that in understanding the SIP, it actually captures to the local government and the local tax entities up to 75% of the foregone taxes through the community service fee and the development fee. So you're really not foregoing your taxes for 15 years. You're foregoing a percentage of them. And I've negotiated one myself, and I tell you, we look at the long haul, not just the short haul, in terms of the incentive. It's a huge investment for these companies with the thresholds that are there. And I've looked at all of these on our sheet that you have provided for you. I don't see any of them going away at the end of 15 years. And that's purely my conjecture, but it's a fairly learned conjecture.
Nobody's moving a wind tower.
And my final, thank you for that information. I just continue as we talk about these things. Yeah. It always troubles me that I feel like we often overlook that I worry about a race to the bottom on the competition between the counties and the whatever to forego this. And we overlook the fact that we have other conditions that make Oregon and those cities and counties preferable for folks to do this, and we have low electricity. You know, we have copious amounts of electricity at small rates. We have dry climates, all the server farm stuff. We have other advantages that, and I'm concerned that, you know, when we do this and we forego that revenue for, even though there is the local, there's the it's not all foregone, but it's not distributed to all the taxing districts necessarily, the schools, et cetera, that we then, because of the way we fund our schools, we end up from the state making up for that foregone revenue locally to the state school fund.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could elaborate a bit, Representative Smith Warner, on how it worked in the wind farm country. Initial investment for a wind farm is fairly expensive, as I said, $1.5 million or so a megawatt. And so what happens is those projects depreciate quickly, like within 10 years. There's also a production tax credit that goes away in 7 years. And so you see the value go down quickly in 7 years from initial high investment. And so what the SIP does is it levelizes that payment for the company investing over 15 years. And so we are in a very competitive situation. The wind resource in the gorge isn't the best in the country. It's much better in Wyoming and Montana. But so we'll be competing against those. We're still competing against those. But we were able to attract that investment here because of power line infrastructure and this arrangement where they would levelize their tax payments over 15 years. And so we anticipate that a lot of these wind generators will be repowered with newer equipment in the generator part and then be revalued at some point in paying full taxes.
Thank you.
Representative Nellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, and then I was wondering if you would explain something that you said. I sort of understood it. The first question is, is there any sort of job creation requirement for any of these things? I'm looking at a list of some that exist, and you can see some where there's, you know, 3,400, and then you see some of the projects where it's 5, 6, 13, you know, so I'm trying to get a sense of, like, you know, does that play into the factor or how you decide whether or not to do this in terms of what kind of job creation it might create? Is there a requirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, what I should say about the requirement for jobs is that in the strategic investment program, there really is nothing in the statute that requires jobs. Therefore, that's why the negotiations must take into consideration other factors, and that's including those that are very localized, that may not exist in another county or even across the county. But in terms of the jobs, they are not required. We keep track of those, of course, and it's very important. One of the important things about these kinds of businesses that invest here, it's their suppliers and other factors and other businesses that come along with those investments that really make the difference. They don't work for the company, but they make a difference. And, of course, the construction projects, construction of these massive entities also matter to the county or the city or et cetera.
All right, and then my actual question is, you started to explain something about, I just caught the end of it. We were questioning about the property, the tax, taxes that are forgone, but you said you negotiate it wasn't a fee, it was like
a community service fee. Yeah.
Could you explain that just a little bit more? I think that's pretty important, and I think I missed it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative.
And the bill raises the cap on that fee from $500,000 to $2.5 million,
right,
if I understand
it correct. And this is
now,
part of the correction.
Now go ahead and explain, yes, answer his question.
I'm really glad you picked up on that, because that is really the crux of the issue for us. There's two main issues. One, raising the threshold when you have large projects. For example, I know that in our county we're negotiating now for a potential project up to $4 billion. And it would be a little embarrassing to only tax the first $25 million. In particular, when you can't make up the difference of that with a community service fee, which, understand, the community service fee is a fee that's negotiated in this contract that would be up to $2.5 million, which is quite a bit of tax revenue. And you're not talking about two and a half. You know, there's a difference between what you're taxing on property value and what you're taxing or the amount you're actually receiving. So those two things are a little convoluted. But with the community service fee, to be capped at $500,000 is handcuffed, frankly, for a large project.
So you okay? So like, for someone like me who's trying to figure out how government has the ability to, you know, I'm not totally anti these kind of things. I want to make sure that we're getting a good return on our invest. You know, they're going to bring jobs or something, and it's going to. So part of that fee is part of our ability to guarantee. Hey, we're going to get something that's worthwhile.
Correct.
We're going to forgo some taxes, but we're getting something else instead.
I'm sorry, you go ahead, and then
I just wanted to add, as we negotiate those community service fees, most counties invite the whole community, and we created a committee in Sherman County to do that. Mm-hmm. We now have a new pre-K through 12 school in Sherman County and a $2.5 million library, thanks to community service fees.
Mm-hmm. That answers one of the questions I had, which is where does the money that you collect in a community service fee go? Who gets it? And I think you just answered, we do that by agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you just said.
And Mr. Chair, just to say, the statute actually requires that 75% of all the taxing authority within the county under special districts and the cities must participate and in however this the community service fee is distributed. But with the increase in taxes paid that go to all the taxing districts, including schools, that makes up the difference. Most local leaders, the first thing they care about is their schools. So they are usually at the table talking in these negotiations to be sure that we've covered everything that's needed, given the kind of investments that's being made.
Do these projects tend to be of the type that Mr. McCarthy was referring to, that are very, very capital intensive,
yes,
and with very rapid depreciation of value, or do they tend to be something else?
I think, Mr. Chair, part of that is true. I think there is difference depending on who the company is,
right.
Intel, et cetera, compared to a wind farm or some other kind of investment. Frankly, Business Oregon is in the room if you'd like to ask them the difference, because they keep track of all this very carefully.
Well, I mean, we've heard about wind farms. We know that you put a lot of money in up front, and there's almost nothing that goes in afterwards. You know, there's no additional investment, and of course they wear out, and then they have to be redone. You put up higher towers and a bigger system,
or
and all of that,
whatever else,
all
yes.
of those things. Sure. Mm-hmm. We certainly know already that when you're dealing with Apple and some of the other companies that might be setting up in rural areas, that they're investing a lot of capital up front in servers that become obsolete very quickly.
And so then have to be replaced, yes.
Well, and so those are all very capital intensive. We had a bill 2 years ago, maybe it was last, no, it was 2 years ago, around a solar installation where the potential builder of the installation wanted to levelize, and that was the word that he used, the property taxes that were paid so that he could afford to finance the thing with the electric, with the fees that he could charge the power utility in return for the electricity. So you have this giant amount of money going out at the beginning, almost nothing going out later, you know, the repairman with the pickup truck. And you've got to finance that piece at the front end. That's the kind of thing you're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And so you'd rather have the business come in and charge them the property tax over a long period of time, which they can pay out of receipts, so they don't have to finance that piece as well as the initial investment. Is that a reasonable way of summarizing what the business interest is?
Mr. Chair, exactly. And that's what that gives us a competitive advantage against other states that may not have this type of program. It also allows the local government to have a steady stream of income that allows them to budget reasonably.
Right. It doesn't do you much good to get a whole lot of money, a whole lot of percentage of nothing. And then have to save up most of it for future years.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would simply remind the committee, too, that this is not a bill to authorize this sort of approach. This is a bill in which they've come forward asking that the amount that they're allowed to collect is increased.
Right.
And the interesting thing is no one else signed up.
Well,
so the business people, business people aren't here to say, gee, this is a bad idea. So thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 936. What's your pleasure?
Let's move them, these two.
All right. Colleagues, we're going to open the work session on Senate Bill 149. Kyle, you want to give us the short version? This is the helicopter bill, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just as a reminder, SB
the helicopter one.
149. Primary proponent the committee heard from was LifeFlight, and it is a look-through statute allowing for LLCs that are owners with nonprofits and also have a government owner to be able to qualify for existing property tax exemptions with that LLC structure. Again, the importance is the property and the nonprofits would have to be qualified nonprofits that could be exempt, and the property has to be used in accordance with the property tax exemption statute that it would otherwise qualify for. That probably didn't make too much sense, but it's really about the organization of the LLC being able to qualify for property tax exemption when a government owner is part of that LLC. That's the difference.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Chair, move Senate Bill 149A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves Senate Bill 149A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Colleagues, I have one comment. Several of us have thought long and hard in a paranoid fashion trying to figure out how somebody could sneak something through on this bill. We haven't been able to figure it out, so I'm inclined to vote yes on the motion. Any other discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Okay, now the big question. Who would like to carry this bill? Representative Hernandez? You want to carry it? Thank you. Representative Hernandez will carry.
If you figure out what got snuck through.
With that, we'll close the Senate bill, close the work session on Senate Bill 149 and open the work session on Senate Bill 181. Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 181A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves Senate Bill 181A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Now the key question again, who'd like to carry this bill? Should I carry it? I guess maybe I will. All right, Barnhart carries. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 181. Do you want to work any of the others today? This SIP bill could be worked, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 936B. Representative Vance?
Chair, I move for Senate Bill 936B to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Vance moves Senate Bill 936B to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Smith, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Kocher. I just wanted to declare a potential conflict of interest. I serve as an enterprise zone in multiple enterprise zones mm-hmm. in the state, and while this is different, we are doing the SIP one right now.
Yes, this is the SIP one. Yeah. Yes.
Quite often I work with companies to work with them to become eligible for the SIP
right. And
to negotiate agreements, et cetera. I do want to be real clear, though, there's no financial gain to me in this, but right. I do use this tool.
Well, in fact, if anything, this means that the companies that you work with will end up paying more taxes than less.
If I do my job correctly.
Yes, thank you. I think you are supposed to put that in writing to
I'll
the clerk, and you'll take care of
yep.
it. All right. Thank you. Any other discussion on the motion to move Senate Bill 936B to the floor with a due pass recommendation? I don't see any. Any objection to the motion? Without objection, it is so ordered. Now the key question, who'd like to carry?
No, don't volunteer me.
I was looking at the more rural folk, but if you don't want, I'd be happy.
I can. Have
Are you willing to carry that
sure
one? Representative Smith will carry. Thank you. If we pause long enough, we'll get you to do it.
Remember when
Representative Mueller is not in attendance.
That's
often a volunteer in and of itself.
Representative Smith, do you want me to reconsider that?
No.
No? All right. Representative Smith will carry it. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 936. I think what we heard was that, well, we have this long, long Senate Bill 701, which I think people ought to at least look at.
27 pages.
Senate Bill 162 might need an amendment. So let's hold those over. Colleagues, we don't have anything scheduled for Monday as yet, but I think we should hold these over till Monday and assume that we're going to have at least a short meeting on Monday. I will note that we are meeting as part of the Joint Tax Credit Committee tomorrow. We have posted for public hearing bills having to do with the residential energy tax credit and with the low-income housing interest issue for public hearing for tomorrow. So please advise the people who are interested in those bills, because under the imminent adjournment rule, we only have to give one day notice for that public hearing. It's not my intention that, or I think Senator Hass's intention, that we move any of those bills, but that we hold the public hearing on the topic tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
So we'll, yes, Representative Nunes.
I know some those bills are popular. What am I trying to ask? Should we encourage people to come and testify? Or
yes.
Do we, yep. Okay.
Sure.
All right.
I mean, that's at this stage, given that it's June. That may be our only hearing on the topic, not just the bill, but the topic.
Okay.
All right. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, you have 11 minutes before we have to go back on the floor. Thank you very much. The committee's adjourned.